also just first of all to thank Rabbi Greenberg once again for setting this up and the lunch and everything else for the series this year, but also that I had a meeting several months ago, trying to figure out what could be done in terms of a Chaverim style program for the female students, and we haven't yet come up with anything, but ideas are welcome. I'm not sure exactly how to do it, but I would certainly like ideas. So the shiur for today is a pre-Purim shiur. It's called Jews in Foreign Palaces, Yosef, Daniel, and Esther. And the idea for the shiur actually came to me last year when I taught Sefer Daniel over the course of the year. And I kept seeing similarities between the story of Daniel and the Purim story and the story of Yosef in Paro's palace. But I never really sat down and put it together and then decided that for the sake of this lunch, I would sit down and finally do the work. And it paid off, because this is there's so much there, so much that I didn't realize as I was going through Daniel, but then once forced to actually look at it seriously, I found the stories themselves have striking similarities, right? They're on a very basic level, right? Yosef, sold down to Egypt by his brothers, he's now a Jew in exile, he is then jailed, and then he rises to power by interpreting dreams. Daniel, taken into captivity by the Babylonians right before the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, he then is brought into the king's court and trained to be a member of the court. He is about to be killed when he interprets the dream of King Nebuchadnezzar, and that's the way that he is saved. We do have another chair up here if anybody wants it. In Daniel you see a parallel to Yosef, and then we have Esther. Esther, who is a Jew living in exile under the Persians, she is taken to the palace and becomes the queen. Her people are almost exterminated, and then she manages to rise to power and to primacy and brings Mordechai along with her, saving him from death. Granted, there is no dream involvement in that story, but what is similar to dream involvement there in the story of Esther? Oh, come on. What is similar to interpreting somebody's dream in the story of Esther? Somebody who dreams and has a frightening dream. Achashverosh and he can't sleep, right? Achashverosh's sleep is disturbed, and there's an explanation there for why his sleep is disturbed. That was very close. There's a lot more to see in terms of the parallels as we're going to see. But my goal here is to look for similarities in the stories and in their messages and in terms of what they teach us. Because in a very real sense, we are Jews in foreign palaces. In the sense, obviously, that we are in Galut. We're living here in Canada. But also in the sense that we are often in a position to actually influence things. In the same way that Esther was able to influence, in the same way that Daniel was able to influence, in the same way that Yosef was able to influence. There's a great news story that came out this morning, or at least I saw it this morning, maybe it came out 2 weeks ago, I don't know, about Norwegian Cruise Lines. Did you hear about this? It's a remarkable story. Norwegian Cruise Lines had a stop in Tunisia for some cruise of theirs, and the Tunisians would not allow Israelis to get off the boat. So Norwegian Cruise Lines retaliated by saying, okay, we are not going to stop in Tunisia ever again. Simple as that. We take Tunisia off. They're not getting our dollars. They're not getting the tourism. Nothing. Something like that. I'd like to assume in a perfect world that that happens because of someone's ideology, that there's somebody in the office there who says this is just wrong, and therefore I'm going to take a stand like that. But in a pragmatic world, we understand that it probably also has a little bit to do with Jewish customers and people who lobby and make a statement when something like this happens. And in that sense, we are like Jews in foreign palaces. We are able to be influential. Incidentally, if you make sure at some point today after the shiur, go online, find out about this story, and get the contact email and phone number for Norwegian Cruise Lines and thank them very much, and then book your next cruise. No, the... Okay.
Sponsored by YU.
Yes, there you go. So let's look at common elements within the Pesukim as well as the Medrash. First of all, we have certain constants across the three stories in terms of the key players, in terms of the protagonists as well as the antagonists. One thing that's common to all three, and I gave you a little summary at the top of the sheet because we're going to be going through an awful lot of material here. But one of the constants is that they're all described as being attractive. Esther you're familiar with, right? And the Gemara has a debate. Is she naturally attractive? Does God make her attractive? But we're told that Esther is attractive. Yosef has the classic line also about his beauty, reflecting that of Rachel, his mother. And Daniel, we are told, is picked to be part of the king's court because he is attractive. More than that, take a look at source number one, please. This is a medrash in the Sifri, one of the oldest bodies of medrash. It's commenting on the sentence in Birkat Kohanim, in which we are told that Hashem will shine His face upon us, Ya'er Hashem Panav Eilecha, Vichuneka, which could mean He will show you favor, but it also can mean He will give you chen, He will give you favor in the eyes of others, and that's the way this medrash takes it. The medrash is clearly sensitive to the similarities between the stories. Look at this, Vichuneka in source number one, Yitain chenecha, Be'enei habrios, He will give you favor in the eyes of His creations. V'cheinu omer, and so the pasuk says, Vayi Hashem es Yosef, vayet elav chased, vayitain chino be'enei sar beis hasoar, that Hashem gave Yosef's chen in the eyes of his jailer. Va'omer, and then in Esther, bati Esther noseis chen be'enei kol roeha, she had chen in the eyes of those who saw her. Va'omer, vayitainu elokim as Daniel, l'cheinu l'chesed l'rachamim, Hashem gave Daniel favor as well in the eyes of others. The same term is used regarding Yosef, regarding Daniel, and regarding Esther. Clear? Just by the way, just to make sure the chronology is clear, when I started this and I presented the three stories, I gave you Yosef first and then Daniel and then Esther. That wasn't a sexist thing, putting Esther at the end. It's because actually chronologically that's the way it works. So just in terms of framing when these are, because this medrash actually changes the order by putting Esther in the middle. It's historically, it's Yosef's story first, obviously, then Daniel, and then decades later you have the story of Esther. Okay, but not only are the heroes of the stories all people of chen, all people who are attractive, but also the kings involved have a certain consistency. Yosef and his king, his Paro, and then you have Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, and Esther and Ahasuerus. What is common between Paro, Nebuchadnezzar, and Ahasuerus? So a little bit depends on how you read this paro. Is Yosef's paro the same paro that we would encounter later on? The Medrash says yes. The Psukim seem to indicate not. But assuming that it is the same paro, all three have an arrogance about them, and they need to be humbled. Ahasuerus has that happen, you know, you see it right from the beginning, where he can't stand the idea that his wife is going to defy him. He has this insecure arrogance about him, and he insists that everybody should obey him. Nebuchadnezzar has this whole arc play out through the first four chapters in the book of Daniel, where he is arrogant, and then he is brought low. And Paro, of course, is legendary. Paro of Mitzrayim, again, assuming it's the same Paro down through from Yosef's time and further along, he is so arrogant that when Moshe brings blood, he turns the water in Egypt to blood, instead of saying to his magicians, hey, turn the blood back to water, he says, I'm going to prove that I can do it too. Bring more water. Find some rare water in Egypt and turn that to blood also. Paro also has this problem of arrogance, which is its own sheer. But there are constants in the personalities in all three stories. More than that, the plot elements are so similar. In all three stories, we find that Hashem acts behind the scenes. Right? In Yosef's story, Hashem is entirely behind the scenes. If not for Yosef saying, your dream is God telling you something, other than that, we wouldn't know that God is behind the sale of Yosef. His brothers are behind the sale of Yosef. We wouldn't know that God is behind Yosef ending up in jail. He's in jail because of what happened with Potiphar's wife. We wouldn't know anything about Hashem's role at all if not for Yosef saying so. God is behind the scenes, and He acts by disturbing the sleep of Paro with this dream. In the story of Daniel, Daniel is taken into captivity, and then he rises in the court, and then he interprets the dream. Once again, Daniel is the one who mentions, hey, this is God involved. Without that, we wouldn't actually know. And in the story of Esther, classically, everybody, I think, is probably familiar with the fact that we don't find Hashem's name even in the book of Esther. Everything is depicted as being, as Hashem being behind the scenes. More, all three stories hinge upon a king doing one thing. If you think about Esther, okay, what is it about Ahasuerus that entire story hinges on, from beginning to end? What behavior of Ahasuerus? Oh, come on. What does Ahasuerus do in the story, besides drink? Yes? Impulse. Good. Stronger than impulse? It's because of a particular kind of impulse, right?
Just kill people.
Well, anger. Anger. Ahasuerus's dominant feature in the Megillah is anger. Vashti won't show up. All right, he gets angry, off with her head. the you know, Haman is found there lying on the bed with Esther. He is angry every step of the way. There's also fear involved with him, and I think that's also a key element. I shouldn't downplay that. But really, a lot of his story is about anger. Think about Yosef's story, right? Paro also. The story begins, Yosef is only able to rise to prominence because Paro was angry at the butler and the baker. That's what makes the story go. If Paro never gets angry at the butler and the baker casting them into jail, how's Yosef ever going to end up interpreting Paro's dreams? And the story of Daniel has the angriest king of all. Nebuchadnezzar has an anger like no other. When Nebuchadnezzar has his dream and he can't explain it, and he calls his advisors and they say, "We don't know," he says, "Well, I give you two choices. Either you explain my dream," or he actually is crueler than that. He says, "You have to tell me what I dreamed and tell me what it means." He doesn't tell them what the dream is. There's some debate as to whether that was, you know, a trap for them or whether he couldn't remember. But he says, "If you don't tell me what I dreamed and you don't tell me further what it means, then I'm going to chop you up into small pieces and destroy the home that your families live in." That's literal. That's a straight translation from Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar is the angriest king of all. So take a look at source number 2, please, on your sheets. The Medrash notes the parallel. Hikziv HaKadosh Baruch Hu Adonim al Avdehem Litein Gedula LaTzadikim. This Medrash explains that Hashem is the one driving the anger. It says that Hashem caused masters to be angry at their servants in order to elevate the righteous. Paro katsaf al abadav. The word katsaf I underlined in order to heighten that so you can see it. Paro was angry at his servants, the butler and the baker, to elevate Yosef. And then avadim al adonehem, Hashem angered these slaves at their masters. That's talking about another anger in the Purim story, which I forgot to mention, which is katsaf bixan vaseresh. Bixan and teresh get angry, the same word, katsaf, at Achashverosh, and that's what leads to the plot against Achashverosh, which leads to Mordechai being able to defuse the plot, which leads to him being grateful to Mordechai, and so on and so forth as the story evolves. Now, this Medrash doesn't mention Daniel. I don't know why, but take a look at source number 3, because the same word katsaf plays a key role there. This is when the advisors are not explaining the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. I brought you the pasuk. Kol kavel dana Malka binas uksav sagi. At that point, the king became inflamed and greatly enraged. V'amar lahavadu l'chol hakimei Babel. He said he would destroy all the sages of Babylon, and that's when he issues his threat. So it's all about anger. More than that, take a look at source number 4. Medrash on Eicha. The pasuk in Eicha says, "Karasi shimcha Hashem mibor tachtios." The Yirmiyahu says, "I called your name, God, from the pit below." And the Medrash says, that's Yosef, because Yosef is rescued from a pit. It's Yirmiyahu, because he temporarily ends up in a pit as well. And it's Daniel, because Daniel is thrown into the lion's den, right? So Daniel also is rescued from a pit. There you don't have an Esther parallel. Esther and Mordechai do not end up in pits. So not all the parallels will ride through all three of the books. But lastly, in this issue of the plot elements, all three of them are given royal clothing. Right? You're familiar with that. Mordechai goes riding out, and of course Esther, Vatilbash Esther Malchut, Esther wears royal garb when she goes to Achashverosh. We get a whole description of her royal garb also in the beginning of it. And Yosef, we know, rides out in Egypt with royal garb. And Daniel is given royal garb as well. All of them end up with royal clothing. So that's another way in which we see the parallels. Actually, I brought it here in source number 5, a Medrash in Tehillim, which I'll just note here. You can see it, but it talks about the way that these various figures had royal clothing. So that's in terms of common plot elements, right? You have constants in the personalities of the players, you have constants in the plot elements, and also all three of them perform similar actions. I mentioned in the beginning, Yosef and Daniel interpret dreams, right? But there's more than that. All three of them save the Jews from a threat. Yosef saves the Jews from starving, his brothers who are living up, back home in Canaan. Daniel, your fault for choosing to record. Daniel also saves the Jews. We're told that Nebuchadnezzar has a frightening dream about what's going to happen to him, and Daniel volunteers advice to him. Much as Yosef volunteered advice to Paro, Daniel volunteers advice to Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, this is what you should do to forestall the suffering that's foretold in your dream. You should give tzedakah to the needy. And the Medrash suggests that he was talking about the Jews who had been exiled, who were now impoverished, and he's trying to help them by directing tzedakah to them. And of course, Esther saves the Jews, that we all know. Not only that, all three of them act to save the king or to save the empire. Right? Yosef with the dreams, Daniel with the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, Mordechai and Esther with Bigson and Teresh, they all act to save the empire as well. And last, within this, there's also similar language in source number 6. This is something for those who were there this past Friday night. The assistant rabbi candidate at the Bayit actually talked a lot about similar language between specifically Yosef and the Book of Esther. He didn't do the Daniel part. But take a look at this Medrash, which actually does a lot of the homework for you. The Rabbi Yudin b'shem Rabbi Binyamin Omar, Boneha shel Rachel, Nisan Shave, Ugdulasan Shave. Here, on your sheets, there's a mistake. I only quoted after I made up the sheets, and I emailed Rabbi Greenberg, but he had everything so on the ball that he had printed everything out already. But I'll show you the mistake now. Rabbi Yudan, in the name of Rabbi Binyamin, said, Boneha shel Rachel, the sons of Rachel, Nisan Shave. So I translated it here as miracle, but that's a mistake. I was writing too quickly. It's their tests. Nes like Nisayon. That's what it's talking about. It's clear when you read the Medrash carefully. It's just that I wasn't reading carefully. I was just translating on the go. But he says, their tests are the same, and their power, when they rise to greatness, is the same as well. What do we mean, the sons of Rachel? We mean Yosef, obviously. But Mordechai also, we are told, comes from Binyamin. The Gemara discusses how he could be Ish Yehudi and still be Yemini, but he's from Binyamin, and therefore he's a descendant of Rachel. And so you see here, Daniel does not fit this pattern. Daniel is from Yehuda. But they play it out here. Nisan Shava, they have the same tests, meaning, Vayhi Kedabra El Yosef Yom Yom. Potiphar's wife speaks to Yosef Yom Yom every day, and they speak to Mordechai saying, why don't you bow to Haman, Vayhi Bamram Elav, or Kiamram Elav, depending on your edition, Yom Vayom. So it's the same speech, Yom Yom. With Yosef it says, Velo Shama Eleha. He would not listen to Potiphar's wife. With Mordechai it says, Velo Shama Alehem. He would not listen to them. Ugdulasan Shave, and their rise to authority is the same. It says for Yosef, Vayasar Paro Es Habato. Yosef took off his ring. And it says regarding Mordechai, Vayasar Hamelech Es Habato. The king took off his ring. Vayiteno Sal Yad Yosef. He gave it to Yosef's hand. Vayitanala Mordechai. He gave it to Mordechai. Vayalbeish shows so big day sheish, he clothed him in linen, and then v'nason halavush v'asus, the clothing of Mordechai, and so on. You can see it here. You don't need me to read out for you. You've got Hebrew and English. But the point is that the language used here is the same for the testing and the rise to power of both Yosef and of Mordechai. Parenthetically, just to follow through from Friday night, and what the candidate, what Rabbi Spitz had said Friday night, was that he thought that the author of the Megillah is actually using similar language to what's used with Yosef in order to highlight the parallels between the stories so that we would learn lessons, because they can choose to write it as they choose, but they'd specifically borrow language. It's an interesting idea. But what we're seeing is something I think that's broader. What we're seeing is not just a shared word here and a shared word there. What we've seen, and I know I'm running a little bit quickly with it, but I don't want to corrupt your schedules here with this, and I want to get everything in. What we're seeing here is constants in terms of the personalities involved, whether the chen and beauty of the heroes or whether the arrogance of the villains, the common plot elements, God being behind the scenes, operating by disturbing the sleep of the king, all three stories hinge on the king getting angry, Yosef and Daniel are saved from pits, they're all given royal garb, you have the dream interpretation, saving the Jews from a threat, saving the king or the empire from a threat, the similar language. It's so clear that there are ties between all three stories, but our sages actually go further with it and make these links, even stronger. If you take a look at source number 7, please, on the flip side. The Gemara in Megillah does something fascinating. Has anyone here ever actually read Sefer Daniel? Okay, we got a couple of who have read Daniel. It's such a worthwhile read. You got to read Daniel. You can fall in love with Tanakh just from reading Daniel. It's magnificent. You've read the parts that are in Hebrew. Okay, so no wonder you don't read any of the rest, because the parts in Hebrew are hard. The parts in Hebrew, other than the first chapter, are all these odd visions of the future. You got to read the Aramaic parts, which is why people don't read it. But anyway, the point isn't that. The point is that in the first parak of Daniel, you find something which makes sense of something you learned in grade school. Okay? Anybody who went to yeshiva grade school, I think, learned the story of Esther and her famous diet. Right? What does Esther eat in the king's palace? Sorry? Nuts? Seeds? Right? Seeds is usually what people say. Which affects what minhag, what custom of ours? According to the Rambam, that's the idea of hamantashen. It has nothing to do with a three-cornered hat. Haman was not an American colonial whatever. It has to do with having pastry filled with some kind of seed, poppy seed or whatever it is, because the Gemara says that Esther ate seeds. Take a look at source number 7. That's where you see it. Vayishaneha ve'ezna aroseha letov beis hanashim. The pasuk in the Megillah says that he altered her and her maids, Esther and her maids, for the best of the women's residence. That's the pasuk in the Megillah. So what does it mean? He altered them for the best? What is that? What does it mean? He gave them the best. So Rav says, Shechila machal Yehudi. He gave her Jewish food. That was the nice thing. He gave her kosher food. Even though Esther isn't telling anybody she's Jewish. Nonetheless, he somehow gave her kosher food. Ushmuel amar shechila kadre dechaziri. Shmuel says what seems to be the opposite point of view, that he fed her the backs of the necks of pigs. Oref is kadla. Although I should know, that's following Rashi's explanation. The Aruch, who is slightly earlier than Rashi, actually contends that it should be read as kadli dechizri. And kadli dechizri means that it's fine lettuce leaves, which he says are given to royalty, because greens would be very rare. So either she's eating greens, according to that, or she's being given treif. But the last line is the one that gets everybody's attention. Rabbi Yochanan said, see, zeronim. And then he quotes you a pasuk, and the key is the pasuk. The pasuk he quotes you is from Daniel. Vayiha meltzar nosei es pas bagam v'nosei lahem zer onim. Because if you read the opening chapter in Daniel, you find out that after Daniel and his friends Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah are taken to the king's court, they try to turn them into Babylonians, and not just into Babylonians, but into really vassals of the king. And so they change their names to give them Babylonian names, taking away their Jewish names, all of which have somehow the name of God involved, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and they give them instead these Babylonian names, which have their own meanings that are not for right now. They also teach them Babylonian script, and they teach them to speak the Babylonian tongue, and they try to give them what's called patibaga, which is food from the king's table. Patbag in the Aramaic. So they want them to eat the scraps off of the king's table. So Daniel says nothing doing. And he works the hierarchy there to get them to give him seeds instead. He wants seeds and he says, don't worry, we'll be fine. And sure enough, they turn out to be fine. They're better nourished than everybody else because a vegetarian diet is good for you. But that's Abarbanel who says that, Rav Sajigo, not me. But the line here says that they had seeds, and from there the Gemara draws that that's what Esther ate. You follow what the Gemara did? There's nothing in the Megillah that says Esther ate seeds. It just says they had something that was better than everybody else. But the Gemara is making the connection to the story of Daniel. You follow? So this classic thing is a connection between the two. Another connection drawn in the Medrash. Take a look at source number 8. Source number 8 says, Ulefisha zacha Yehuda vihitzila Tamar ulishnei baneha min hamisa. Because Yehuda, at the last minute, saved Tamar, as well as the two sons she's carrying from death. That's its own story, obviously. Vihitzila Yosef min hamisa, and he also saved Yosef, so he's responsible for having saved Tamar. Two kids, Yosef, that's four people. So Hashem saves four of his descendants. One, Echad min Habor, that's Daniel, because Daniel is from the lion's den. And then three from the fire, that's Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who are thrown into the fiery furnace and survive. So there you see them making another connection, right? Yehuda saves Yosef, Therefore, his descendant Daniel is going to be saved. But wait, there's more. Take a look at source number 9. Is this entirely too fast, or are we getting it?
We're good?
It's true. Okay. They smarter than your average bear. So the Medrash in Esther Rabbah in source number 9 talks about Zeresh's advice to Haman. Did you ever wonder about this passage? Haman is trying to figure out what to do about Mordechai, right? And he has this idea about the tree. But then later on, after he has begun to fall before Mordechai, what does Zeresh say to him? What does Zeresh say? In Mizera HaYehudim Mordechai Asher Achilosel in Polafanav Lo Sucha Lo. If Mordechai is of the Jews, forget it. You're never going to beat him. She just woke up. Where did she get this information from? What does Zeresh know? Why does Zeresh know that the Jews are special? Where did she come by this information? So take a look at source number 9. Zeresh is apparently a student of Tanakh, or of recent history, because it's only a couple of decades earlier for her. Amrolo Ishto, Haman's wife, said to him, Adam Zesha Teshoel Alav, this man you've been asking about, this Mordechai, Im Mizera HaYehudim, that's the quote from her, if he is of the seed of the Jews, Lo Sucha Lo, you will not defeat him. Meaning, Im Lo Tavo Alav V'chochma B'meshelo Nisa Echad Mibnei Umaso. The only way you're going to succeed is if you act to him in a way that none of his countrymen have been tested. What do you mean? Well, Hananiah and his peers were already saved from fire, so you can't use fire on Mordechai. And Daniel was thrown into a lion's den, so you can't try a lion's den either. Oh, I know, try a 50-foot tree. 50 amma tree is a lot higher than 50 feet. But that's what you got to do for him. Zeresh is drawing on the story of Daniel. My point is not to say that this was the word-for-word conversation between Zeresh and Haman. That's its own great discussion about what Medrash is doing, which is beyond the scope of what we're going to get to today. But my point is that the Chachamim, in recording this, are making another connection between the stories. The story of Daniel and the story of Mordechai and Esther. As well as the story of Yosef. I actually didn't bring it here. The Medrash here in source number 9 includes Yosef as well being saved from the pit. Okay. The further thought, in source number 10, you find out what happened to Daniel. Sefer Daniel is very odd in terms of its ending. What happens to Daniel at the end of Sefer Daniel? We have two people who have read the book. What happens to... Oh, you only read the Hebrew part. Oh, it's Hebrew at the end. What happens to Daniel at the end? Nope. We don't know.
No, he just disappears.
Disappears. Yeah. We know nothing about Daniel after that story. The Sefer ends with his vision that there's going to be a Tchias HaMesim, there will be the resurrection of the dead. And then that's it. Book's over. And we know nothing about what happens to Daniel afterwards. So the Gemara says, I'll save you. Take a look at source number 10. Vatikra Esther laHasach. Esther called to Hasach. Amar Rav Hasach zet Daniel. And Rav says, yeah, Hasach is Daniel. How do you get the name Hasach? Because Chatchuhu, they cut him from his power. He was cut down, which ties into other ideas regarding what happened to Daniel in the courts of the kings after Nebuchadnezzar. It's a longer story. But so we have him associated with Hasach, or according to Tosfos in Megillah, he quotes another source that he is Mimuchan, one of the king's advisors. What we're doing is, we're transplanting Daniel from his own story into the story of Mordechai and Esther, making another link between them. There's much more. There are actually many more midrashim you could bring to associate them. But I want to get to the big question now, which is, we've seen that the characters are personally similar. We've seen that there are links between the action in all three of the stories, the way God operates in the stories. We've seen that there's similar language. We see the way the Medrash builds on this and even amplifies it. What are we supposed to learn from these stories? Is it just a case of, okay, so the same story happened three times in different places in Jewish history? Or is there something here that we actually can draw from this? What lessons can we learn from their actions? What would you say? Not having read the bottom part of the sheet. What am I supposed to learn from Esther's activity in Ahasuerus's palace? Okay, so I'll suggest something. The number one is emuna. The number one is emuna, and the sense that when we seem to be abandoned, what are we supposed to do? So we find Esther davening to Hashem. We find Daniel multiple times in his sefer davening to Hashem when he is in need. We don't find Yosef davening, right? I don't think we ever see Yosef daven explicitly in the psukim, but we do find it with Daniel and Esther. With Daniel, it's especially explicit. That's actually the earliest source we have historically for Jews davening three times a day, is when the pasuk in Daniel says explicitly he went to daven as he had always done three times a day, morning, afternoon, and evening. That's the earliest recorded source that's explicit. I mean, we have the sources that Avram davens and Yaakov, Yitzchak davens and Yaakov davens, but of a particular Jew davening three times a day, that's Daniel. We also have Yosef and Daniel crediting God for their success. I gave you the pasuk references, so you can look them up here on the sheet. But we find that Yosef, when he interprets the dream of Paro, says it's all from God. And Daniel multiple times says it all comes from God. There's a confidence in Hashem. That's number one. Number two, and that's obviously a lesson for us, But number two, it's about retaining a Jewish identity. All of them have people try to blend them in. I mentioned before that Daniel and his friends have their names changed, right? But it's not just them. Yosef has his name changed, right? They give him a new name, which is Tzafnat Paneach, good. And Esther has her name changed. What does it change to? Esther. Her name is Hadassah. Esther is a Persian name. Right? There are a lot of discussions about this. The fact that Mordechai sounds like Marduk and Esther sounds like Ishtar, these are names of Persian deities. Mordechai has other sources also, but that's not germane right now. The point is, they try to make you blend in. They give you their names, they give you their clothing, they give you the diet that they have, as happens with Daniel. And so it's up to the Jew to say, I'm going to take a stand, and I'm not going to become the person that they want me to become. Taking a stand even when it's not halachically required. Like in the case of the diet for Daniel, there's a possibility he will be executed for refusing that diet. Or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, when they refuse to bow, as they do, to the king's statue. The king's statue is not an idol, according to most authorities. They choose not to bow because they don't want to indicate that they have given in to Nebuchadnezzar. Mordechai, with his refusal to bow to Haman, we all know the medrash about Haman having an idol hanging around his neck, and that's why he won't bow. But on a very simple, straightforward level, Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh. He's not going to bow. They take a stand even when it's not halachically required. I'm not in any way diminishing the medrash about the idol around his neck. That medrash is solving certain halachic questions about what Mordechai did. But you could similarly bring not just about bowing, but not participating in the Suda of Achashverosh, not participating in Achashverosh's meal, where the Gemara tells us they had kosher food available. Nonetheless, you don't belong in Achashverosh's meal. You don't blend in to become like everybody else, and that's most clear with the way they identify themselves to those around them. Yosef is known as what in Egypt? How do they identify Yosef when they talk about him? The butler and the baker say, V'sham itanu nar ivri. Right? Yosef is telling everybody when he's in jail there, I am an Ivri, right? Ivri meaning from that family way up there on the side of the river. That's who I am from. Daniel is identified as a Yehudi. Esther does not, right? Because she's told not to. Why she's told not to is part of the story, but apparently only because she's being told specifically not to identify that way. So that's a second point from all three stories, is not to blend in. Third, Kiddush Hashem. We already talked about them crediting their success to God. Yosef credits his success to God explicitly. Daniel credits his success to God explicitly. And Mordechai says to Esther, if you don't go to the king, God is going to do something. The Jews are going to be saved. The only question is whether you're playing a part or not. But they credit success to God, and they're loyal to God. When Yosef says to Potiphar's wife, I can't do what you want me to do, what is his last reason? He says, I can't do this because v'chatasi le'elokim, it would be a sin against God. I am loyal to God. After all is said and done, I've been kidnapped, I've been sold, I've been turned into a slave. I remain loyal to God, and I can't do something that's going to upset God. Daniel says to the servant of the king, I cannot possibly make myself repulsive by eating the king's food. I can't become migo'al. I can't become repellent by eating the king's food. Do you know how dangerous it is to say to a servant of the king, I can't make myself repulsive by eating your king's food? That's like one-way trip to the guillotine. Particularly when you're dealing with Nebuchadnezzar, who really has no compunctions about doing that sort of thing. But nonetheless, he declares it. They insist on their loyalty to God. That's the third lesson of there, is Kiddush Hashem. And then the fourth and last one I find to be the most fascinating of the bunch, because the other three I think are obvious to everybody, but the fourth one I think is not necessarily so obvious. And that is to look for opportunities for chesed. Even when the Jew is in galut, even when the Jew is in exile, looking to help not just other Jews, but looking to help those who are around you, meaning the non-Jewish population. Saying, if I have to be in exile, let me help the people around me. You can trace that back to Avraham and the bracha of Nivrachu v'cha komish b'chaso adama, the other nations will be blessed because of you. But we find it here. How does Yosef help those around him? I'm sorry? He interprets the dreams for the butler and the baker first, and then for Paro. Good. How does Daniel? Daniel gives advice to Nebuchadnezzar to save, how Nebuchadnezzar can save himself from disaster. Esther and Mordechai help Achashverosh with the plot of Bigtan and Teresh, and they choose not to let him get killed. Take a look at these midrashim, source number 11, and then we'll see source number 12. Source number 11 talks about how Hashem has made the Jews kechol hayam. It's a pasuk in Yeshaya. Hashem says, you are like the sand of the sea, and the nations are going to be like misrefot seed, pyres of lime, where you burn lime. So he says, the comparison of the Jews to sand and the nations to lime is as follows. If you don't add sand to lime, it will not endure. I'm not a lime maker, so I don't know enough about the physics of lime, but apparently you have to add sand to lime or it's not going to endure. So too, without the Jews among them, the nations are missing something. There's a need for them to have us. And so the Egyptians would have been lost to famine, the Babylonians would have been destroyed, the sages of Babylon would have been destroyed without Daniel. We are necessary for other survival. That's not just a Judeo-centric view of the world, it's a mission statement. It's a statement of, we are responsible to look for ways in which we can help others. And take a look at the last source on the sheet, please. The Medrash has an interesting point here. Achashverosh is not a friend of the Jews, even at the beginning of Megillas Esther. He's not our friend. He doesn't like us. We don't like him. He's part of the government that has dominated us and held us in exile. Right, until Cyrus comes along and chooses to allow the rebuilding. Depending on how you understand the chronology of the Purim story, they actually began allowing the building of the Beis HaMikdash before the time of Achashverosh, and Achashverosh actually stopped the construction. We don't like Achashverosh. So why is it that when Mordechai hears that there's a plot against Achashverosh, why doesn't he just allow it to go forward? Why does Mordechai choose to actually tell Achashverosh? Why doesn't he say, oh great, you know, down with Achashverosh, maybe the next king will be nicer to us. So the answer could be because he's a realist and he knows the next king isn't going to be any nicer than the current king. But the Medrash says Mordechai looks at the track record. Source number 12. He says, when Yaakov met Paro, he blessed him. When Yosef had the opportunity to help Paro in Egypt, he helped Paro. When Daniel had the opportunity to help Nebuchadnezzar, he helped Nebuchadnezzar. Above and beyond revealing the dreams, he gave him advice to help him going forward. He said, if you give tzedakah, you'll be okay. And so Mordechai said, okay, I guess I should do it. And so he told Esther, and Esther told Achashverosh, and the story went forward. So what we see here is, despite resentment over our situation in Galut, in exile, nonetheless, we are supposed to make it our mission to help the people among whom we live. So that's four lessons that come out of this. The lessons of Emunah, the lessons of keeping our identity, the lessons of Kiddush Hashem, and of Chesed to the people among whom we live. Last point. there is one weakness that happens in all of these stories, which is that none of them actually lead to Geula. None of them actually lead to redemption. As wonderful as Yosef, Daniel, and Esther are, what's the end of the story with Yosef? Come on, folks. The people who are listening on the audio are going to think no one's here. Sorry, what happens at the end? Right. We end up being slaves in Egypt. Yosef is a great success, and four generations we're going to be slaves as a result. Right? Daniel, as wonderful as he is for Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't get us out of exile in Babel and then Persia. And Esther, we still have Galut after. There's some discussion, is Esther's son Cyrus who builds the Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash? Maybe. It's possible to argue more for Esther leading to a good result than for Yosef and Daniel. But ultimately, I think there's a lesson here as well, which is Al Tiftachu B'Nedivim. Right? We don't trust in princes. They may want to help, they may have great gifts, but at the end of the day, our trust is not in these particular human heroes who we have, but the trust is in Hashem to ultimately bring Geula. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.